dodges. I ride in this wind on my good horse. I call you my shiny black bears to the playhouse of fortune to take the bright silver and gold you have taken from somebody else.
You're tuned to WEOS Geneva or WXXE Fenner, Syracuse. This is Unwelcome Guests. I'm Lynn Gary. On June 6th, a diverse coalition of religious and secular organizations which had come together to form the Not In Our Name Coalition gathered in New York, Los Angeles, and Berkeley, California to commit themselves to the Not In Our Name Pledge of Resistance. The pledge reads, "We believe that as people living in the United States, it is our responsibility to resist the injustices done by our government in our names. Not in our name will you wage endless war. There can be no more deaths, no more transfusions of blood for oil. Not in our name will you invade countries, bomb civilians, kill more children, letting history take its course over the graves of the nameless. Not in our name will you erode the very freedoms you've claimed to fight for. Not by our hands will we supply weapons and funding for the annihilation of families on foreign soil. Not by our mouths will we let fear silence us. Not by our hearts will we allow whole peoples or countries to be deemed evil. Not by our will and not in our name. We pledge resistance. We pledge alliance with those who have come under attack for voicing opposition to the war or for their religion or ethnicity. We pledge to make common cause with the people of the world to bring about justice, freedom, and peace. Another world is possible, and we pledge to make it real. What might another world look like? What would its values be? For the next 2 hours, we'll hear a forum recorded during the protests against the World Economic Forum in New York City, where a variety of speakers address the topic, Another World is Possible, Globalizing Justice and Solidarity.
Well, hello, and welcome to the final plenary address of the Student Counter Summit to the World Economic Forum. This is Another World is Possible, Globalizing Justice and Solidarity, and it's great to see everybody turn out tonight. I know there's a lot of apprehension in the air regarding what's going to go on tomorrow, but glad to see everybody's out here supporting causes of social justice, and I think that we've got a lot of great speakers tonight laying out positive visions for the future. So, speaking first, we have Starhawk, who's a global justice activist, a trainer. She works with a collective called the Root Activist Network of Trainers, or RANT, that trains civil disobedience and direct action for the global justice movement. She works with the Pagan Cluster and Another World is Possible, and is the author of, I believe, 8 books, including The Spiral Dance and The Fifth Sacred Thing.
Hi. Well, it's great to be here and see all of you here, and to have the opportunity to maybe pause for a moment before we jump into the events of the weekend, and between all the information of the last 2 days and all the discussions and all the issues, and actually think a little bit about what the world is that we want. What does that world really look like? And I know the global justice movement has often been criticized for not knowing what we want, knowing what we're against, but not knowing what we're for. I actually think we do know what we're for. It's not always easy to say what you're for when you're a movement that's actually very diverse. the same vision of the world might not hold true for an indigenous farmer in Chiapas and a college student in Antioch, Ohio. Socialists or communists or an anarchist or all the ists will come up with different ideologies and different visions. But underneath all of that, I think there are some common points. And I think that what we hold is a vision of a world that's very different from the vision promoted by those people hanging out at the Waldorf Astoria and the WEF this weekend. I'm not going to go into what their vision is, because I think we all know it, and I think you've all had ample opportunity over the last 2 days to hear all the facts and figures and reasons about why that vision is not sustainable and not viable and causes immense pain and destruction in this world. I think the vision that we want is fundamentally different in that, first of all, we're talking about a vision of a global community. And community is one of our strongest values. And by community, I mean that businesses, enterprises, however they're organized, have to actually be rooted in a real place and responsible to real live human beings, people that they have to actually, on a day-to-day basis, look in the face. So the idea that you can have functional enterprises that aren't rooted, that are endlessly free-floating and able to take root anywhere where labor is cheapest or where environmental standards are most lax, we have to go out the window and we have to kind of rein them in and tie them down back home. Because ultimately, we believe that whatever you do in the way of organizing an economy, organizing a business, organizing a bunch of people to do necessary work and sustain themselves that way, the reason that we do that is to make that sustainable to and serving communities, rather than having communities exist to serve businesses and serve profits. By community, we also mean that everybody in the world should have access to the means of life, to the means to make a life that's healthy, that's viable, that gives them the opportunity to realize their dreams and aspirations. And that should hold true regardless of what race they happen to be born, or what gender, or where they happen to be born, or any other of those issues that become grounds for prejudice and institutionalized oppression. So we have to be, people will say we're an anti-racist, anti-sexist, anti-anti-movement, but we're basically a pro-human diversity, pro-freedom movement. Thirdly, by community, we mean that we as human beings and as a society actually have some responsibility to each other, that we're supposed to be here to take care of each other. And we have to be willing to provide for each other's needs. And that means that we do owe people those basic safety things of food and clothing and shelter. That we do owe people things like health care and education, and that's something we have to be collectively responsible for. Because, you know, the thing is, in life, everybody has hard times. Everybody has times when you get sick, or where you trip and break a leg, or where your lover walks out of your life and you can't function, or something really messes up and goes wrong. And that individuals shouldn't be left alone to try to pick up the pieces and deal with that without any social support. We need to reinstitute those social supports. We also believe in abundance, not necessarily in profits and wealth, but in actual real abundance for those communities. I don't think any of us want to go into like a grim world of sort of gray commissars limiting what we can do. But we might have a different vision of what that abundance is. Abundance might be something like actual clean water to drink and actual clean air to breathe. Abundance might be something like actually having the time in your life to do what you want and not being locked into somebody else's decisions about how you should spend your time and how long you should work and how much you should compete with somebody else. We believe that there's a way to have abundance in this world But it's not the direction that we're being thrust in by the current global corporate capitalist system. That kind of direction focuses on the big, the huge, the mammoth, and somebody's sort of the bland and the universal. It's the Starbucks on every corner. Now in New York City today, it's the Starbucks with three police at every corner. Pretty soon, every Starbucks around the world will have to have complete part of the franchise, you know? You get the name, you get the graphics, and you get the three cops, you know, to guard the place. We believe that abundance actually comes from observing the way nature works, that an economy is like an ecology. In fact, we have this very radical and shocking notion in our movement that the environment is actually real. Can you handle that? I hope you're sitting down for that one. That, you know, the fact that the polar ice caps are actually melting should tell us something. That resources are not infinite on this planet or on this globe, and that there comes a certain time where what you need to do to extract and use those resources is so devastating that it's simply not worth it by any sane standard other than that of the accumulation of profits for the few. So the premise of global corporate capitalism is that the economy is infinitely expanding. That's the only way it works. It's like those pyramid chain letter schemes where, you know, you have 10 people send you a dime and they have 10 people send you a dime, and by the time you factor out the mathematics, you'd have to have 33 trillion people all sending dimes for the thing to keep going. After a certain point, it can't keep going. And you know, the corporate globalization people like to say, their sort of slogan is, a rising tide lifts all boats. You know, if the economy's expanding, then everyone's lives are gonna be improved. You know, the yachts are rising, but so are the little, you know, fishing boats of the peasants are all rising together. But to me, it shows they're not only unclear on the concept of the economy, they're unclear on the basic concept of tide. Because no tide rises forever without becoming a complete catastrophe. In fact, we are seeing a rising tide. We're seeing the oceans rising because the polar ice caps are indeed melting. So we're not going to have expanding abundance, expanding resources based on the idea that we can infinitely keep exploiting more and more and more and more and more, because we just happen to be alive at this historical moment where we've reached the end of more. On the other hand, if we actually look at nature, there are ways that we can have abundance that are in balance with nature. In nature, abundance in an ecosystem doesn't necessarily come by getting more and more and more and more and more all the time. What it comes is from how you use what you've got. So in nature, you get water flowing into a system. It's not how much water comes in, but how long it stays around and how many times it's reused and how many plants it's recycled through. You get many kinds of nutrients. Again, it's not that they come in and they flow out really quickly. You have a very dead, dull, simple system. But if they come in and they're used and reused and reused again and transformed into something else and something else again, you have a very complex and very vivid and resilient and beautiful ecosystem. And that is true also of economies. If we have an economy, if you have a local economy where a dollar comes in and a dollar goes out somewhere else, you have poverty. But if you have a local economy where a dollar comes in and it's passed around and recirculated and re-spent over and over again in that same place, you start to build a complex and abundant economy. There are also a couple of resources that we do have that are, if not unlimited, unlimited by our standards. One of them is the sun, and the other is things like wind, renewable sources of energy that by all human accounting are basically unlimited. And those could be the basis of a sane policy, a sane world. We actually have the technology to make a shift to an economy that's not oil-based. You have a diesel car right now, you can run it on vegetable oil. And you could say goodbye to Chevron and Standard Oil and all of those people. We're on the verge of a solar hydrogen economy. And we're actually at a place where if capitalism showed half a grain of intelligence, it could still save itself. I don't really see any signs it's going to do that, so the rest of us have to step in, because if we don't do that, we're also heading to a place where every ecosystem on the planet has been under assault for long enough that it's on the verge of losing its resiliency. So we're really at a crossroads. We're really at a choice point right here. And that's why, again, what we want is a world where we stop and we say, you know, the viability of the planet has to be our highest priority. We cannot sacrifice that on the altar of profits. To do that is not only evil, it's stupid. In fact, there's a man, Bill Mollison, who invented this system of ecological design called permaculture. One of his sayings I love is that what evil is stupidity rigorously applied. You know, I think for some of us who are working in this movement, that's, for me, it's what makes me the most crazy. It's not that we have insurmountable problems, it's that we actually have solutions to some of our worst problems. What we need to do is to provoke, marshal, gather up, and stimulate the political will to put them into place. And we need to get the obstacles out of the way. And unfortunately, the obstacles just happen to be the major power holders in the economy, in the politics, in the military, and the police force. But I don't think we should let a little thing like that stop us. So we want a world that's sustainable. We want a world that's abundant. The other truly unlimited resource we have is human creativity. And that's one reason why we cannot afford to waste anybody. We can't afford to waste anybody's potential because of where they happen to be born or who they have to be born or because their body works differently than somebody else's or looks differently than somebody else's. We need a world in which all of that kind of creativity is nurtured and fostered and appreciated. And we believe that is going to be a world that's better, that's more truly abundant for all of us. So we want community, we want abundance, we want equality, because without equality we can't really have community or abundance. And we want liberty, like our statue in New York Harbor. We want freedom, we want democracy in the real sense of the world. And that democracy means that people actually have a voice in the decisions that affect them. And that has to include economic decisions, not just what we've labeled as political decisions, because economic decisions are crucially important in people's lives. That's why we object to the WEF. You know, I mean, really, a bunch of rich guys want to go have a party wouldn't necessarily interfere with our lives. The problem is that that party is a place where they take thought and make decisions that impact the rest of us, and we have no voice in those decisions. We're supposed to have a democratic process in this country. Our mayor in San Francisco, where I live, was just quoted as saying, you know, you can't win an election if you're outspent by your opponent. Now, I don't think a lot of people would argue with him. There may be some exceptions, but that's the general rule. Well, that is wrong. That means we don't have democracy in this country. And what we want is a system where it doesn't matter how much money you have. You have a voice in the decisions that affect you. Or it doesn't matter who you happen to be born or who your father was or what color you are, you still have a voice in the decisions that affect you. And that's why when we take actions, we attempt to organize on those directly democratic principles. Well, we have things like spokes councils and assemblies, And you know what I have seen happen over and over again is that when people get a taste of that, it will come to an action. You know, maybe somebody, I was in jail in Seattle, and there were people there who had never been in that kind of protest before, that kind of demonstration before. There were people there who hadn't really expected to get arrested, just ended up in jail. By the time they got out of there, they were just so in love with a group, a community of people that took care to listen to their voices, that took care to try to give them a chance to say, what decisions are we going to make? How do I participate in it? That they never looked back. That I often thought the worst mistake the system ever made was locking all those activists up together in Seattle. I mean, I look around New York and see a lot of people I was in jail with in Seattle, and it's like, okay, they're still here and they're still at it. When you have a taste of that, that kind of actual empowerment, you really can't settle for anything else. So we're looking at a vision of a world that would foster that kind of empowerment in every aspect. And that means that a lot of things would be organized differently. Because if you really look at the way things are structured, most of them are structured along the lines of furthering the mammoth and the monolithic and the centrally controlled. You know, so we would have energy systems, instead of being based on central power grids, that were based on local, small, renewable resources. Instead of furthering the growth of giant transnational corporations and Starbucks and McDonald's and the sameness imposed all over the world, we would further things that are small, that are local, that are linked and locally integrated, mutually beneficial kinds of systems. So you might have your local bookstore again, your local coffee house, your sustainably grown coffee network that supplies different coffee houses. We would favor diversity rather than uniformity. And we would put a high priority on keeping open a certain kind of psychic and real space. I think for a lot of people in the movement, especially a lot of young people, one of the main things that drives people out to the streets and motivates people to take action is the sense that space is closing all around us, that there's no free space left, that everything has a logo on it, everything becomes a means of advertising, everything exists from the playground in your schoolyard to what you put on your body to advertise something else that ultimately is not benefiting you, but benefiting someone out there that you have no connection with and no say in. What we say is that some things are actually sacred. Sacred in the sense that they're of ultimate importance. That they're too important to be exploited. That they're too important to be a means of someone getting profit from them at someone else's expense. That they're too important to be despoiled. There's the things that sustain our lives, like water. Water is one of the big, big issues coming up. And we live in a society that basically says, well, you have the right to do anything you want to the water, to take it, to own it, to buy it, to sell it, to pollute it, as long as you don't do it too badly. You know, in the world we want, we would say, you know what, water should be the primary value. If you're doing something that's putting crap into the water, you're doing something wrong. And if you can't do it without that, then you shouldn't be doing it at all. We're saying that water is something that belongs. The Coach Obama Declaration that was written by these wonderful people in Bolivia who took back their water supply from privatization by Bechtel, they wrote a Coach Obama Declaration, and their declaration says, water belongs to the earth and all species and is sacred to life. And water is a human right and a human need. Because you know what? You can't replace water, and you can't do without water. So they're calling for an international treaty to protect our right to water. Some of the other things are things like that are, again, irreplaceable, like our genetic biodiversity, which has already been eroded by genetic engineering. Already, if you go to the place where corn was developed, where the wild ancestors of corn still exist in the wild, what they've now found is that every single species is contaminated with genes from genetically engineered corn. We've lost an incredible biological treasure, and those things are under assault again everywhere around us. So again, there's a kind of complete insanity to think that some corporation has the right to take away a heritage like that, which should be treasured and should be protected. And they're things that are simply so rare and so beautiful and so inspiring, like old growth redwoods. I don't know if any of you have ever had a chance to go through an old growth redwood forest. You know, there's so little of them left. 99% of the old growth forest that was on this continent 500 years ago is gone. Those things, again, should be protected. So that's some of the things that we want as a movement. And I think they transcend whatever your ideology or whatever you ist you are. I think those are things that we hold in common. I want to just sort of close by saying a few words, especially to those of you who are students and who are young right now. Because I think this is in some ways a very hard time to be young, and in other ways a very exciting and a very challenging time to be young. Yeah. It's a time really where we're at the crossroads, where the future we live in is being contested all around us. And the power to shape that future is what is under question. And I believe that we don't actually have a lot of leeway if we want to live in a viable future. I think that I'm not alone in feeling that, that everyone I know who has any kind of intuitive understanding or connection with the earth, everyone I know who actually does get that the environment is real, it's not just something you watch on the Discovery Channel, you know, we get it, that this is like the Titanic, you know, the iceberg is there. And there are things the earth will always recover from whatever we do to her. She's amazingly creative and resilient. But the losses that we can contemplate on the way are too painful and too horrific for me to be silent about, or for me to stand by and see happen. And that includes like the loss of the nature, but also the loss of human life and of human culture that'll go with that. We're at a point where every indigenous culture on this planet that's still left is under assault, partly because they're tied to land and to ecosystems, partly because they have been for so long the voice of these values. And again, I think our movement needs to stand, it's not to stand with them, our movement is in some ways the rising of an indigenous consciousness that's finally coming up from the south and up from, you know, the woods and out of the mountains and starting to resurface even here in New York City. And that consciousness, again, basically says, you know what? We're living on a planet that's real. We're living on a planet that's alive. It's alive and as complicated and intricate as any living ecosystem. And that not only is something that should be a warning to us, that should be an inspiration to us. That should be a place where we can really draw strength. Because I really believe that in this movement is the rising of a collective consciousness that serves these values and that has a strength and has a kind of power that ultimately is stronger than the power of the entire police and military state that we see being marshaled around us even as we speak. You know, we live on a planet that 2 billion years ago was full of these little one-celled life forms that essentially had kind of run out of food. They'd expanded to the limit of their opportunity. They'd eaten up all the kind of free-floating big organic molecules around. They were starting to starve and die in massive numbers. And at that point, some of them figured out how you take sunlight and turn it into food. Now that is an amazing thing when you think about it. Like, none of them had brains. Brains were not going to be invented for a long, long time yet. Scientists, our smart scientists here at Columbia University can't even really even map the process of photosynthesis yet. They're still working on it. These are like little one-celled organisms that just invented it. To me, that speaks of this great power of creativity that exists in the universe and exists in the earth. And I believe ultimately that power is stronger than the power of the gun and the bomb. And that we're here at this conference because we are agents of that power. We're agents of the embodied love and creativity of the universe. And I believe that we're here and we're taking action this weekend in spite of the threats, in spite of the force that's marshaled against us, in spite of the campaign of demonization, because we are agents of that creativity. And so I hope, just to close, that all of you will be out on the streets this weekend. That we'll not only be here thinking and learning and talking and creating our alternatives, we'll take that kind of creativity and we'll take that kind of knowledge out to say that big no that has to be said, but in a way that embodies that vision that we carry and that shows that another world really truly is possible and more than possible. And we insist on it, and we're going to make it, and we're going to make it real. So thank you all.
I apologize for the difficulties in the sound system. We're having somebody look into it, and hopefully we'll have that resolved as quickly as possible. But speaking next, we have Barbara Garson, who is the author of a book that recently came out called Money Makes the World Go Round, which is sort of a story of how your dollar moves through the economy. So please give it up for Barbara Garson.
Tall enough for you to see me. I, since Starhawk spoke about the positive, I think I'll mention something generous that someone here for the World Economic Forum, somebody inside, somebody very important, did. I mean something really generous, and more generous than deciding to come to New York and buy coffee and a Danish from a New York deli in order to show his solidarity with all our sufferings, which the WEF has decided to do this year. But there was a diphtheria epidemic in Russia a few years ago. Donna Shalala, who's actually my height and who was the then the head of the health and whatever they call that department, and the CDC, Russia called on the CDC, our disease control organization, to go in there and come up with some formula, what they could do about this diphtheria. And they did. They did a study, but Donna Shalala said all they could do was a study. They weren't allowed to spend any money, any American money, on diphtheria in Russia. But they took their study and they gave it to George Soros, who is the big money manager. And George Soros put up the money himself. He did all the vaccinating that was necessary in order to short-circuit that one particular diphtheria epidemic in Russia. And that is, of course, supposed to be an example of someone inside that organization. And there are others, by the way, who are worried, decent. They might make nice fathers. They are all men, boyfriends, whatever, if that's your inclination. But even socially responsible people. But that's supposed to be a good example. I said to myself, diphtheria in Russia? Now? At the end of the 20th century? And they have no means. They have to call on an individual millionaire to do the vaccinating because they have no public services. What's going on? If you look around the world, you see in the last 30 years an incredible decline in the most basic, simple things like public health services around the world. How did this happen? Well, 30 years ago, this World Economic Forum started meeting. Now, I don't mean to say they met and said, let's see if we can cause epidemics. Absolutely not. They started meeting in Europe. It was a European organization. And it was in the beginning, it was in the sort of middle 70s, and they began to notice that they were the CEOs of major European companies, and they began to notice that they were making money, but they didn't have any place to invest the money. They didn't know what to do with the money. And that might sound like not much of a problem, you know, that you have too much money. But it does get to be a problem for them. Now, this was just at that time, it was just European CEOs. Then they looked around and they saw that the same thing was going on in the United States. At this time, they did not call themselves the World Economic Forum. But the same thing was going on in the United States 30 years ago in the middle of the 70s. So they expanded their organization. The European CEOs, American CEOs, put it together, and to them, that amounted to a World Economic Forum. And they called it the World Economic Forum. They started meeting in Davos, and they started to deal with this big problem. What to do with the fact that they had this money, but nothing to invest it in. That doesn't mean there weren't any needs or anything that had to be built, but they couldn't sell any more of their cars or any more of their Weetabix or any more of their Cadbury's chocolates or the things they were making in Europe and the things they were making in the U.S. So this big problem of what to do with too much money is a kind of a funny one. When I started to write Money Makes the World Go Around, which I did by, I wanted to cut through this globaloney, this global babble, and see what this global economy amounted to. So I took half of my book advance that the publisher gave me, and I put it in a tiny little upstate bank in a small town in New York, and I put the other half in a mutual fund, and I decided to see what would happen. And the first thing I noticed that really surprised me is that whoever had my money was really stuck with it. The little bank was paying me a little interest. They didn't know what to do with it. So they passed it along to Chase, and I spent a lot of time in the Chase Fed Funds desk and up at the trading halls watching them handle this money. And for them too, since they were paying the little bank interest that was paying me interest, the money was like a hot potato. Whoever held on to it had to pass it along to somebody else, and they had to pass it along to somebody else who would pay interest, to somebody who could charge somebody else. They were part of that process that Starhawk was talking about, that kind of pyramid scheme or a chain letter that she talked about. You had to get rid of it. You had to pass along that hot potato. They couldn't pass it along more in their own Europe and America, in their own what they call the advanced world. So they looked around and they said, there's a big world out there. And that is the beginning of what we call the global economy. It started in the 1970s. It isn't the first time, by the way, that capitalists have gone global. And they decided to, but they looked around. It wasn't so easy to get their money out there. That may sound silly, too. It sounds like everybody wanted it. But there were really laws that slow down the process of the money, because that money, as it spins around, is very dangerous. It leads to that chain letter effect that Starhawk spoke about. So there were laws, there were rules. And coming out of the World Economic Forum, starting in the late 70s and middle and the beginning of the 80s, was a bunch of ideas. Ideas that would enable them to break down what were really traffic lights and stop signs that were keeping money from moving around so quickly. And those ideas were like privatization, liberalization of money flows, deregulation. Now, it's not illegal to sit around in a room and think that you would like to develop some ideas that maybe other people would pick up. I mean, hopefully we're doing that here in this room. But I want to give you a sense of what some of those ideas led to. And I think I'm going to switch around a little bit and use the example that Starhawk used about water and privatization. In the course of writing this book, I became an investor in a lot of things. And one of them was a water company called Suez Lyonnaise des Eaux. Now, that's not a water company like they put water in a bottle. That has its problems too, but it wasn't that kind of water company. And it wasn't a water company that built a water pipe. It was a water company that bought private water systems and then sold the water back to the people who used to own it before in those countries for money, money that could get back to me. But they could invest my money in the water company and then they could make money out of the water company. And then they'd have the problem investing that money again. Now, the truth is not many people in the first world wanted them to own their water company. So it's basically a really stupid idea. How it came to be an idea that could fly around the world, privatization as something progressive, is really amazing. They got kicked out of Grenoble. They had a contract in Grenoble, France, but and they had bribed the mayor. The mayor's in jail right now, but not somebody from my company. He went to jail for much less time. And they needed to be able to buy these water companies. So they can't even buy the water system in New York. Even Bloomberg won't sell that to them, although he is a member of the World Economic Forum, has been for years. So where can they bring the pressure for this bright idea? They helped to create something out of the World Economic Forum. They take great pride. If you get onto their website, you'll see that they take great pride in having created the World Trade Organization. And the World Trade Organization put great pressure on South Africa. There's a country where the water system is being privatized by my water company. Well, it's already privatized in Johannesburg. But when you privatize water, something that used to be free or felt free to people, you have to get them used to paying money first. So the World Trade Organization and the IMF demands that South African government start charging for water even before they privatize. And that's on behalf of my water company, Suez Lyonnaise. So what happened there is they put a very minimal charge, 4 rands. That's not a lot of money, I understand. But some people had their water cut off because they couldn't pay it. So they started going down to the river to get water. And that resulted in a cholera epidemic in South Africa. Cholera epidemic. I mean, it's not such a little joke. Very distressing thing. Nonetheless, the World Trade Organization and the IMF still insist that they pressed through with that water privatization. Now, I told you there were generous people inside the World Economic Forum meeting right now. Bill Gates has spent a lot of money on health in Africa. I mean, he really contributed money that he out of his pocket. One of the problems for him, but Bill Gates doesn't have enough money to do it because it costs a lot of money to buy drugs in South Africa. Why does it cost so much money? Because out of the World Economic Forum came the idea of the World Trade Organization. And their idea is not free trade. You know, I think I might even be in favor of free trade. I think, I'm not certain. I look at it very closely. If there was such a thing. But their idea of free trade is the people in different industries get together and say, what conditions would we like for trade? Oh, the U.S. has a 20-year copyright on drugs. Other countries have less. I got a great idea what we'll call free trade. Everybody has to have a 20-year copyright on drugs, patent on drugs. That way the drugs go on costing an awful lot for an awful long time. Now, you would think, why would a country like South Africa go along with it? Because who wants to be labeled a rogue state in this world? I mean, if you have a problem in the U.S., like with anthrax, you break the copyright and you do it. But not in South Africa. They couldn't afford that label. So they, in fact, carried on with that policy, too, which makes the drugs very expensive. As a matter of fact, drugs that you can buy from Brazil or India for pennies. So they're stuck with that problem. I've got to race through this. They're stuck with that problem. Right now, some people are going to jail in Brazil, in South Africa, being arrested. I've got a note saying 5 minutes, and that's perfectly fine with me. I'm not going to, just for buying drugs from Brazil. This is the kind of world that has come out of the World Economic Forum's plans. And that is not because these rules, liberalization, deregulation, they don't come out of greed in a way, they come out of desperation. They come out of a system where this money has got to keep moving. That's a very dangerous system. And as Starhawk pointed out, particularly dangerous at a time when you just can't go on building, doing, and melting the ice caps. So it's time that's a little room in which certain ideas came out. Now, those people had a lot of money to spread the ideas that came out in that room. We're sitting in another room, and we're coming up with other ideas. And I might say there are a lot of FBI agents, a lot of deans at the school. They look at us and they say, wow, these ideas keep changing. We call them anti-globalization people. And suddenly they call themselves, no, they're just against corporate globalization. And then a bunch of people decide to have a teach-in and they call their website Students for Global Justice. Wow, those ideas are also coming out of little rooms and spreading very fast. And it's quite amazing. I mean, I have to say, I am so amazed at what we can do and how we can spread some of those ideas with very little money, without the problem of being stuck with too much money. And I am actually so honored to be here to see the beginning of those ideas traveling around. And I'm certainly going to be out there tomorrow. And I hope everybody will be out on the street noon or wherever we're going to do your own stunt. But for those of us who are not doing that kind of stunt, noon at 59th Street and 5th Avenue. Because small as we are, and it's not small, it's a nice group, and unmoneyed as we are, we really are the only people who are saying another world is possible. Not probable, at least I didn't think so before I came here. I thought our voices were so tiny, but at least possible. So that it is such an exciting thing for us to be out there actually saying it's such a necessary thing in response to such an enormously loud voice on such a big microphone, a working sound system with which they are able to say what they have to say. So... So our message does sometimes sound a little fuzzy because our loudspeaker isn't such a good system. But it is so important, it's so hopeful, it's so wonderful that we're out there saying it. Because their system is desperate and out of control. And there are a lot of worried people in there. I'm telling you, a lot of people, arch capitalists, who are worried themselves about deregulated capital. So I am so glad we're going to be out there and so glad you invited me here to speak. Thank you very much.
Speaking next, we have Monami Maulik from DESI's Rising Up and Moving.
My name is Mona Mee. I'm glad to be out here today. I'm glad the folks invited us to come out here. And before I talk about the specifics of what we do, I'm from an organization called DRUM, DESI's Rising Up and Moving. And for those of you who don't know, DESI is a term in a lot of our languages from South Asia that refers to people from South Asia or of South Asian ancestry. So that means That means India, Pakistan, Nepal, Bhutan, Sri Lanka, Guyana, Trinidad, Africa, England, everywhere where we've been spread out because of colonization and globalization. And I just want to start off, before I get into like the details of the community organizing that we do and why that is absolutely also anti-globalization struggle, I'm going to read a quote that we got from one of the detainees who was picked up in the massive raid since September 11th. He's a Pakistani brother who's been sitting in a Passaic County jail across the river in New Jersey. So he said this to us on January 20th. About 3 weeks ago, in the middle of the night, at about 2 a.m., 10 prison guards came into our dormitory with dogs. They pulled out our roommate from his bed and made him face the wall. They proceeded to kick him and punch him. They hit his head several times. When one of us spoke out to protest, they let the dog loose on that person too. 1 week later, the man who was severely beaten was gone, deported. I am willing to be a witness to this, and so are others. If this country allows this kind of injustice, how can it go around teaching human rights to the rest of the world? And I read this to let folks here know that even though people here who are going to be out in the streets tomorrow, who are public, who are going to be, you know, in front of the TV cameras and speaking up here on platforms, even though we are the face that the media puts out of the anti-globalization struggle, there are brothers and sisters in communities, in lockdown, in neighborhoods not too far from here, who are part of, who are critical, central to the anti-globalization struggle on a day-to-day basis. And just to, you know, bring it back even more, one of the things that really, really angers a lot of people of color who in a lot of ways are marginalized by the way the anti-globalization movement has taken form in this country in the past few years is that there's this notion that the anti-globalization movement started in Seattle, started a few years ago. Well, let me tell you, people in the third world have been doing it for decades. They've been doing it for centuries. And it's a critical factor to remember. It's a critical fact to remember when we here in the first world, when we look critically at who we are, where we're coming from, and what our role is in this movement and have a global perspective on that, of that, and not be fooled by the media that puts faces here in the front of that struggle and further makes invisible the other folks who can't be here and who don't need to be here, who are struggling by other means. I think that another fact that I want to raise is we need to let go of certain terms that we use, or we need to put them into context. So, you know, people in the third world back in my country, in other countries, people in the third world right here understand the anti-globalization struggle as not anything new, because it's just a continuation of liberation struggles, of anti-colonial struggles that many of us have been fighting from our families, from our ancestors, for centuries. And so, you know, those are the same folks who understood 40, 50 years ago that we never really got independence, because it just took another face. It just took a prettier form. And now it's on TV and we call it globalization, but it is imperialism. And it's not much different from colonization. And the colonization that worked before on the basis of racism and using race as a hierarchy is still very much intact. Instead of slavery now, we have prisons. We have prisons in this country that incarcerate the vast majority being people of color, that incarcerate black people, immigrants, Latino people, Asian people, whether we call them INS detention centers or whether we call them jails. So, in that light, I'm going to backtrack a little bit and talk about INS and this whole idea of detention and what it is and how that links up to prisons and also to the anti-globalization movement and globalization and imperialism. Contrary to how the term sounds, INS detention is not something similar to where kids go when they're bad. It's jail. Straight, plain and simple, is jail. The history of the INS in this country has been to be the policing institution, the policing force for immigrant people of color. It's been the reason that immigrant struggles have been controlled. Immigrant movements have been controlled and suppressed so that we don't become too powerful. Just imagine if the millions of undocumented and non-citizens immigrants in this country, you know, who pick the strawberries we eat at the market, who weave the, you know, who stitch the clothes we wear, who drive the taxi cabs outside, who make the food that we eat, who cater and serve us in restaurants. Imagine if those people, the millions of people and their families, got together and organized and stood up and said, no more of this shit. We're not gonna do this, we're human beings. And we're gonna organize and demand that we have human rights, regardless of whether we're called illegal or not. That is a huge threat to the powers in this country. That is a huge threat to corporations. So corporations stand the most to benefit from keeping under control immigrants and people of color. Because if we were ever to stand up and be able to speak up for our human rights, then it, you know, their business would be over. In New York City alone, if taxi cab drivers, if, you know, vendors, street vendors, if women who work in the sweatshops, if all the nannies on the Upper East Side said, I'm not doing this for a whole day, this entire city would shut down. And so that threat is real. We always say in the immigration work that we do that, you know, we're not fooled by this whole notion that the INS and the law enforcement agencies put out here and mainstream puts out that these people are undocumented. Why should they be coming here? Why should they get these rights? And, you know, we need to, like, keep them from coming here and using up the resources. Well, the fact is, if the U.S. wanted to do that, the U.S. could have done that decades ago. It has enough military capacity at the borders and everywhere to stop all immigration, but it doesn't want to do that. It wants immigrants to live here in absolutely under terror so that these communities can be an underclass. These communities can live under apartheid right here and continue to be exploited and make this economy function the way that it does. The INS detention system is not also something new. Since September 11th, I think a lot of people have, you know, been talking about it. It's become the big issue. But we've been fighting the system for a couple of years now, because everything that came out in the Patriot Act a couple of months ago has been around for a number of years. They actually have been around since 1996, the 1996 anti-terrorist laws, the 1996 Illegal Immigration Reform and Responsibility Act. They started the mass incarceration and criminalization of immigrants. They were the factors that initiated the merging of the prison industrial complex and the INS detention system. And so since 1996, the percentage of immigrants incarcerated has risen about 1,000%. The number was somewhere around 3,000 3-4 years ago, and in 3-4 years it went up to 25,000. That makes immigrants the largest growing portion of the prison population in the U.S. I've only got 5 minutes to speak, so there's a lot of other things to say. I'm just going to skip over to why I'm here and why a message that I really want to put out from being in communities that are doing work that's not often recognized or talked about as anti-globalization struggle. I think that, you know, everybody has a role in transforming society, and I think that we can only be truly just and fair if the way we work is just and fair to make that world happen. And what that means is all of us have to look at ourselves and understand what are the relationships between third world and first world. Not just third world out there, far away, but third world right here. And what are our relations to those communities? What are our accountabilities to those communities? What are the relationships between people of color and white people? What are the differences in who can be in what kind of struggle, and what kind of struggles are legitimized and what kind of struggles are not? And where should we be? Where should we be struggling? I don't think it's an issue of identity. I'm not asking people to, you know, hold hands and look deeply and think about your identity and all of that. I'm asking you to think about power. I'm asking you to think about power. If we want a world where the power relations that we see doesn't exist anymore, we have to first be real and acknowledge the power relations that do exist. And often that means looking individually at ourselves and the power that we have in the communities around us and in the work that we do. So I think that we need to really stress understanding allies, understanding what it means to be an ally to different struggles, and understanding what we should be doing within our own communities and where we come from to push forward change. Before I finish off, one of the things that I want to put out in terms of the campaign that we're working on right now to release all of the INS detainees who've been picked up in mass raids since September 11th, and most of them incarcerated in the New York area, is we're asking for an unconditional release for all of them. No ifs, ands, or buts. We just want them out. But that's not the end. If, you know, we achieve victory on this and tomorrow all our brothers and sisters are out, it's not over there. We need to then call for the end of prisons, the stopping to build prisons in this country that are completely ripping apart and terrorizing people of color and poor people. And that's why, for us, it's not an issue of whether you're a criminal or not a criminal, whether you deserve to be in jail or not. If you are in a prison, this criminal injustice system has labeled you a criminal, most likely because you're poor, because you're a person of color, or because you seem to be, you know, an other in some other way. So the fight will continue even after our brothers and sisters are released. And for folks who want to figure out how, you know, they can join, how they can agitate, mobilize support in their communities, you can come to our website, which is www.drumnation.org. One of the things we immediately need in terms of ally support is there are brothers languishing in there for months who have never seen a judge, never seen a lawyer, sitting in a room, have not breathed fresh air in 4 months. We just need basic funds so they can survive, so their families can survive, and they can be strong enough to struggle and win this fight. So give us a call and, you know, do fundraisers, whatever is necessary. And you can also reach us by phone at 212-631-3689. We got flyers in the back. Thank you.
WEOS Geneva, WXXE Fenner, Syracuse.